Hello, and welcome to Inside Briefing, the podcast from the Institute for Government. I'm Bronwyn Maddox. We at the IFG may be based in Westminster, at least when we're not working from home, but there is only one place to start the podcast this week, Los Angeles, and that interview. The shockwaves from Harry and Meghan's astonishing sit-down with Oprah Winfrey are still being felt and will be for some time to come. We're going to be exploring the consequences for the monarchy in the UK and abroad. A bad week for the royal family, but a better week for families across the UK. Schools are open again, in person, with the government hoping that regular testing will keep case numbers down. But an influential parliamentary committee has concluded that there is no clear evidence that the government's 37 billion test and trace system worked. So have lessons been learnt? What went wrong? And a week on from Rishi Sunak's budget, we'll look at the main row that continues, the proposed 1% pay rise for the NHS. The Prime Minister is under pressure to show more generosity. We'll look at the politics of this and where it goes next. Joining me in the studio is that renowned IFG duo, Senior Fellow Kath Haddon, who leads our work on the Constitution. Hi, Kath.
Hi, Bronwyn.
And Alex Thomas, who runs our civil service work. Hi, Alex.
Hello, Bronwyn.
And I'm delighted to be joined today by Luke McGee of CNN. Hi, Luke. Great to have you with us.
Thank you for inviting me. Very delighted to be here.
Great. Tell us where you're based.
Right now, I'm looking west out of a window in Hampstead with a very low sun glaring at me. But normally, I'm largely based in Westminster with occasional trips to Brussels when we're covering EU matters. But for the last year, I've been sat in a very small room looking sadly at a laptop.
Working to US time zones.
Yeah, CNN has really expanded in Europe recently. And not really recently, but the coverage and the interest in Europe has grown. So we try and take a bit of a wide lens of the UK and Europe to explain it to international audiences.
Well, there's been a lot to explain, a lot going on. Let's start with that interview. No one can say the word Sussex still carries its connotations of genteel calm. It was an interview in the City of Angels, which did nothing to lay demons to rest. Harry and Meghan's explosive claims about a royal family insensitive to Meghan's mental health with abhorrent views on race have made headlines around the world. In a short statement of three very carefully worded paragraphs, the palace says the claims will be taken seriously, even if recollections may vary. Kath, this is more than a PR crisis, isn't it?
It is. And I mean, it's an institution in crisis. Again, we've seen that before, and we'll no doubt get into all the ins and outs of that. But I think what's extraordinary about this is it's also a family that seems to be in crisis. And that's, in some respects, why, it's so absorbing to many people, but also why it's sort of so difficult to put your finger on how they go forward from this, because we don't normally see the ins and outs of the family. We hear a lot of stories. You have, those sort of key moments like Princess Diana's famous interview, lots of revelations over the years and so forth. But it's still pretty rare to get this kind of level of insight into the family dynamics, into such a sensitive family problem. And yet it's one that has such huge impact on the institution globally, on our very constitution. So it's difficult to sort of know how this is going to play out, how they're going to sort of manage through the PR crisis itself, but then also tackle perhaps some of those longer running issues that are going to affect them as an institution for possibly years to come.
Well, I know everyone gripped by this is, takes the point about this being a family crisis. Some elements of it are incredibly personal. But when you mention constitutional points, what are you thinking of?
Well, I mean, there's a number of them that, are simply about the monarchy, its legitimacy, the degree of popularity it has in this country, but also around the world, because this is a worldwide institution. I'm sure we'll talk about the Commonwealth and so forth. But for me, the really crucial thing is also this is an institution that is going to be facing one of its biggest challenges sometime in the coming years. And, we hope still not for some time, which is a succession. They will already be planning for it. Prince Charles undoubtedly already thinking about what kind of monarch he wants to be. And, he's had his problems in the past in terms of how he's perceived. He's not going to have the same kind of PR ratings that the Queen has managed. She's portrayed herself as a very apolitical monarch. She's largely trusted. There's quite a lot of, you know, support and popularity for her. So there's already all of those challenges that he faced in terms of navigating that succession. Now he's got a load more accusations that are heaped on his family more generally, but also going to be challenges in particular for him to navigate. And I think that's a really big issue that, you know, not just the monarchy needs to think about, but also the government, because the constitution relies on the monarch for some really kind of sensitive issues. There's reserve powers that aren't really used, but are nonetheless kind of crucial to some of the sort of key bits of our political system.
We'll pick up some of those points about the powers of the monarchy. He may well have been thinking about this for 6 or 7 decades, of course, but as you say, the challenges, he has been able to see it coming, but the nature of the challenges is changing, as you say. Luke, just tell us how big this was in the US.
Oh, it was huge. I mean, when the wedding happened in 2018, I mean, from our perspective, you know, CNN threw everything at it. You know, we brought over our biggest anchor at Anderson Cooper. The coverage was enormous. And I think, you know, something that's perhaps been picked up a little bit this week is, you know, the US affection for the monarchy isn't, you know, when people said, of course, Meghan knew what she was getting into, I really don't know if that can be true, because, you know, the affection is for the family in this sort of quite abstract sense. I suppose all of the things about, you know, the tight-lippedness, it's all quite alien to a lot of American viewers. So it has been a big deal. And of course, they are big celebrities in America. You know, they hang out with, you know, the likes of Barack Obama, and they're friends with Oprah Winfrey. And they were able to get this sit down with, you know, probably one of the most famous interviewers on the planet. So it's a really big story out there, you know, and for all the reasons you've said, it's as much a constitutional sort of you know, mess as it is a really sad personal family story.
How much do you think, Luke, that this was a culture clash? I mean, Meghan said, I didn't think they really meant it, that I would have to curtsy to the Queen. She said it was that point in the interview where she said this was when the penny dropped, that this wasn't just for show, for external, as she said. It was actually, you know, the status of the monarch meant something. Do you think this was, apart from anything else, a tale of culture clash?
Well, I think the way to look at that might be to, you know, re-nose that through the United Kingdom. This is an observation that I'm shamelessly stealing from Delta Poll's Joe Twyman. But, you know, if you look at polling around the generation of Meghan and Harry, you know, there's a big difference between them and the sort of more traditionalist monarchists, you know, who the younger generations do think it's slightly absurd to bow and curtsy to the Queen if she's also your grandmother. You know, they do like the issues and the openness of people like Harry and Meghan. So I suspect it's a culture clash, but I'm not sure it's a American-British culture clash. I think it's a generational culture clash.
That's a really interesting point. And do you think the palace's response, this very carefully worded response, has made a difference?
I think it probably hasn't, in that everyone's already made up their mind about it, it seems to me. I mean, the thing I've been struck by over the last week, before the interview even aired, was, you know, a slew of royal commentators were sort of pushing this idea that it was mostly an undignified spat that didn't really have any constitutional consequences, because Harry was never anywhere near the throne. But, you know, this really does play, and I mean, Kath touched on this, this plays into what happens when Charles takes the throne, because, you know, the affection for the Queen is sort of locked in. That's priced in now for affection for the monarchy. But that what people know about her is that she doesn't say very much. She's given one sit-down interview, whereas, you know, that generation of conservative monarchists might not be entirely comfortable a year or so into Charles's reign, because they know it. You know, this is a man who's basically had aired every opinion he has in his head over the last several years. You might see that the affection for the monarchy from that side of the monarchist goes, and you might see that, you know, this young couple who did want to be open had to leave because they felt that they didn't have a role in there. So you might see affection drip, and as Harry said in the interview, and as Kath said, you know, the monarchy survives on public affection, the validity of it, and the funding of it.
Hmm. Alex, I want to bring you on at this point. You've seen the heart of government really close up. What do you think they're going to be thinking there? The Prime Minister has refused to comment, of course, apart from expressing his support for the Queen. But what are they going to be thinking behind the scenes on this?
Yeah, it's really interesting. I mean, it's worth saying that most ministers, most civil servants, even at the very heart of government, will be following the soap opera and the drama of the story in exactly the same way as we all are, and it won't sort of intrude on their professional lives. But there is a really small, tight corner of Number 10 and the Cabinet Office that cares quite deeply about these sorts of issues. So right at that kind of beating heart of government, there is a kind of profound recognition of the relationship between the executive and Crown, a sort of keenness to preserve these relationships and to protect the Crown. I was reminded, thinking about this, of some of the things that came to light years later when John Major was Prime Minister. He almost sort of seemed to be playing at times a marriage guidance counsellor role with Charles and Diana when they were having trouble. So there is a role for the Prime Minister there. I think the other interesting thing, the more sort of thoughtful political and civil service types might want to reflect on some of the points that Luke was making about the generational divide and how actually some of the issues that the royal family involved itself in, inclusion and tolerance or mental health, are almost now becoming sort of culture war type issues. And so issues that felt a few years ago quite safely depoliticized have become more political. And given that the fundamental sort of mantra in Number 10 and the Cabinet Office is keep the Queen out of politics, that could cause some difficulties down the line, I think.
And what about Simon Case, the Cabinet Secretary, who used to work for Prince William? That was his previous job. Does that make him part of the solution or part of the problem even?
He's one of those people who does think deeply about these sorts of things. We don't know whether he was part of the problem. There's reporting that he was on an email chain when some of these issues were raised by other senior officials in the palace and sort of forwarded on allegations or concerns. But I suspect his main focus will be on staying tangential to the story and not getting too deeply drawn into historical questions. I do think he's well placed. He knows the main actors involved from his job as Prince William's private secretary. He is well placed to play a brokering role and to be part of that. You know, Kath can talk about this so-called golden triangle between the Cabinet Secretary at Number 10, the Prime Minister and his principal private secretary, and the Queen's private secretary. So there'll be lots of delicate conversations being had, I suspect.
On a delicate point, you mentioned their email chains. How much do you think, in a sense, has yet to come out of these deeply private discussions of the past? And you know, obviously the question of Meghan's unhappiness was not unknown to many people in the organization, whatever they did about it.
Yeah, one of the extraordinary things over the last week or so is that things which were either hinted at or sort of known at were acknowledged just very, very publicly. We are not used to hearing senior members of the royal family talk in such sort of stark terms about these personal relationships. I mean, obviously, we don't know what else might come out. Wouldn't be surprised if any investigation that the palace does into the accusations of racism or conversations that were or were not had was conducted sort of in deep private. So I suspect that they will be doing their best to make sure that these things retreat back into that private realm. I think it depends a little bit on how the main actors in this drama, what else they say or don't say, particularly what Harry and Meghan do next.
But also, Bronwyn, if I just come in, I mean, that's part of their problem here. And it goes to this issue of it being a mix of family and institution. Because, and Luke, I know you're interested in the question of accountability, but all these allegations about Meghan and her staff, they've said they'll do an inquiry into that. It's an organisation. They, in theory, have proper HR processes. They can do a study into that, not release it, of course, but nonetheless, they've got a process. But for some of the other claims that they've made, these are claims about a family. So you can't institute an HR process into that. You can't sort of do a massive inquiry into, you know, who made that comment about their son's skin colour. And that's part of the problem that the royal family will now face in terms of navigating their way out of it. We saw today, I think, Prince William saying, you know, trying to counter the view, saying that we are not a racist family. But in any other organisation, any other institution of the state, you would have those kind of inquiries. You would, you know, launch proceedings to make sure that you were showing that you were taking action. But you can't do that when it's a family.
But Kath, you mentioned one thing there, which is the other side of it, if you like, the allegations of that Meghan bullied her staff, which the Times in particular has been running. What do you think the monarchy does with this there? Because that's not exactly a family matter. That's about Meghan and about employees and the allegations that they appear to have made. Do you think the monarchy would be advised to continue with that now?
It partly depends on what's happening behind the scenes in terms of the people that have made the allegation and how, you know, staff working in the palaces now are feeling about it. You know, many of the people have already left, but they've said they're going to do an investigation. So I would assume that those members of staff who've left and, you know, even members of staff now would want to see them. But again, that's going to be an internal process. I think perhaps there is more that they can do to answer questions of whether actually, you know, is this something more widespread? Is this about the way in which the palaces operate? You know, are there behaviours there that we've seen in other institutions? We've talked about Parliament, we've talked about ministers. Are there more things they can do to make sure there's a better working environment?
And let me ask you one other thing. You mentioned right at the start the powers of the monarchy. And in fact, you talked about something, reserve powers. The few powers that the monarchy does have at the moment. Is there any sense in which these could be in question in the future?
I think there is, but I don't think it's necessarily an automatic conversation of, you know, oh, well, now we're going to have to codify all of those parts of the constitution. I think what's more likely, and this is something that I've been talking about for a while, well before any of this came up, what's more likely is if we find ourselves in a situation similar to many we've seen in the last few years where there's a particularly acute moment in British politics. You know, we've had a prime minister in intensive care. We've had, you know, possible votes of confidence in prime ministers, minority government, you know, unclear election results, all those things. That's when the monarch's role in terms of enforcing the kind of the rules that are quite grey and quite murky about what happens next. That's when that's really important. They, in theory, have this power to be able to decide between, you know, one future prime minister and another. If that's Charles making that decision, will there be the same level of trust in him being completely apolitical that there currently is in the Queen?
Really, really interesting question. And particularly if, for example, he said things on controversial questions such as Scottish independence and so on, which we know he feels strongly about. Luke, as we back away from this, I wonder if you could just take us into the big picture of how the world sees the UK in this. It's not a quiet time you and your colleagues are having. The UK has, on the one hand, got the vaccine success, on the other hand, in broad and row with the EU about Northern Ireland, which the US absolutely has an interest in. And then you have this on top. How, in particular, is the US seeing the UK at the moment? Has the picture changed a bit?
I think the vaccine success has been something certainly we've covered a lot. So it has shifted the dial. I mean, it's I'm sure we'll touch on this when we talk about the testing issues. But you know, the American sort of audience is very aware of this fact. So, you know, Johns Hopkins always has at the top of the deaths per capita is the United Kingdom. So you know, the COVID stuff's been a bit of a mix. But I'd say the royal stuff is generally seen slightly differently. It's you know, it is seen as a kind of, I would say it's seen as more of a kind of, I don't like to use the word soap opera, but it's seen as certainly more of that than British politics. I think the thing we always overestimate in this country is the extent to which America believes there's a special relationship.
Yes, is that a phrase I've really not heard very much in Washington, other than the British Embassy garden.
Yeah, right.
But you know, this could have enduring effects in terms of those countries in the Caribbean or say Australia that are questioning whether or not the British monarchy should be the head of state.
I think, I mean, that certainly is the case. I think it's, is it Barbados is going to be removing, Elizabeth will be the last.
Which it had said it already.
Yeah, yeah. But, you know, there's obviously, there's scope for a trend of that. And it was obviously a big part of the interview. I mean, I think globally, one of the big things that's going to come away from it is that, you know, this does remind people of the Diana scandal and the extent to which it rocked the reputation of the royal family. But I'd say, I've actually written a piece about accountability, as Kath mentioned, and very kindly contributed to for the weekend. And I think one of the interesting things that came out of doing that is if you are going to try and sort of get accountability for a member of the monarchy, the only way you can really try them is in the court of public opinion. But something a PR guru, Mark Bukowski, said to me in the piece is, you look at that Diana interview, and yes, it was the three people in this marriage, and it was a scandal at the time, but ultimately, history is long, life is long, and ultimately Camilla's now very popular and she's going to be the de facto Queen of England at some point, I think there's a long way for this one to play out.
Luke, let's use your reference to all that testing and tracing as a pivot to go and talk about just that. We had the reopening of schools this week, of course, and that was a big step on the Prime Minister's roadmap to reopening the country. But we had the Chief Medical Officer saying at the same time, don't look to opening up too quickly. It could all flare up again. And this week, we learned a bit more about just how much the government has spent on what was supposed to be a big part of the key to our freedom. That was the test and trace system. And it spent £37 billion, in fact. And the parliamentary committee that was looking at that said, look, there's not an awful lot of evidence of that helping. Alex, give us a quick summary. Whose report? What did it say?
Yeah, so as you mentioned, it's a report from the Public Accounts Committee and its chair, Meg Hillier. And it actually made some sort of fairly well-grounded, modest criticisms of the test and trace system. It talked about the need to improve the performance data that it produces, the need to do better at matching the supply of tests to the demand of tests to get the most out of the system. A really important point about the need to wean the system off the use of contractors and consultants. Some eye-watering day rate numbers, up to about £6,500 a day being spent on an individual consultant. It talked about when these rapid lateral flow tests should and shouldn't be used, and it said that the system needed to work with partners better. But the thing that really caught the headlines, as you said, Bronwyn, was the £37 billion number, which is a budget. That's not what's actually been spent, but that's the money over 2 years that's been allocated to it. And the fact that less in the report this, so there's a bit of mischievous press releasing going on, I think, but that Meg Hillier went very heavy on the fact that all of this money was being spent and it hadn't prevented the lockdowns at the end of last year, and test and trace, she argued, hadn't had a discernible benefit for the fight against COVID.
How much has been spent?
So we only know up to November last year, and up to November, £5.7 billion. So actually, out of a budget for this financial year of £22 billion, as of November, only, sounds crazy to say only about that number, but £5.7 billion had been spent. So I think there's a pretty high chance that this programme comes in under budget, that in reality, they have as much money as they want.
Is the criticism fair? I mean, there's been an uproar of the £37 billion, as you said, that's in all the headlines, and yet a comparatively small number on what actually is spent, and as you said, possibly under budget. Is that in fact the real story, that the government couldn't manage to get it working as quickly as it expected?
I think that is there's definitely a story about mistakes made early on, a sort of centralised process and time lost in the early months of setting up the system. Also, all those detailed points I made about consultants and data and so on, all of those seem to me to be very fair. I'm not quite convinced, though, that the sort of big picture should have prevented a lockdown criticism is right, though. I mean, there is some evidence starting to emerge that test and trace is having an effect. Interestingly, from one of its biggest blunders, which was, you may remember last year, an Excel spreadsheet error meant that various 16,000 test results weren't put into the contact tracing system. Some academics did some analysis of that and showed that actually those 16,000 test results were geographically tightly located, and more people got ill, more people died of COVID as a result of that error, which is dreadful, obviously, but does show that where test and trace is in place, it is starting to have an effect. So I think it's a bit too simplistic to talk about avoiding lockdowns. And actually, some of the more important things now is the policy response, giving people proper sick pay and so on.
Alex, though, one thing that I just bring up on that. I mean, part of this is the government's own making, because when they, you know, were doing the release from lockdown last year, so last May, that was one of the pillars that they placed on, you know, on it. A test and trace would be one of the ways in which we could live without lockdown. That's what the government was saying. So I agree with you. I think, you know, Meg Hillier has done a classic sort of press release news story, but I can see, you know, the view, not necessarily that you can causally link it to the reasons why the lockdown, there's so many more reasons why second and third lockdowns occurred. But I can also see that that criticism that the government said that this was going to be one of our saving graces and it wasn't, that that is also valid.
All right. So, Kath, can I ask you, what do you think went wrong? You've written a lot about making things happen at the heart of government. And this didn't happen quite in the way that the government wanted, as you described. It didn't perform the role that government wanted in getting us all free. On the other hand, the vaccine stuff has worked really well. Why has one worked and the other hasn't?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I know Alex and Luke have both looked into this in quite a bit of detail. I think for me, the two interesting things are, one is obviously it's not about the testing, as Alex has been talking about. We've been doing a large number of testing. That's where a lot of the money goes. It's been the tracing. And it's also been, remember, this is test, trace, isolate. I can't remember, there's more acronyms to it. you know, it's also been about the self-isolation that's supposed to follow that tracing of people. And that's, you know, been partly about the incentives in place for people to do so. It's been partly about communication, consistency. In terms of the overall program, I imagine the difference with the vaccine program is partly, it's a different logistical challenge involved. I think one of the key things that we've been talking about since last May is that the government decided then to go for a very centralized approach. That is going to be part of a sort of wider examination when public inquiry comes around as to where they decided to really bring things very much close to the centre and not even just to the UK central government, but into number 10 itself in terms of decision making, away from DH, the Department of Health and Social Care, and why they didn't go for a more distributed model, which many people have said might have worked better. I mean, we don't know the counterfactual of that, but that's the key argument.
That's a really interesting point. And as you tucked into all that, there is an incentives point as well. People might not want to be tested and traced if they're going to have to isolate, whereas they may well very much want to be vaccinated. Luke, you wrote a piece for CNN last year with a headline, "Where Did It Go Wrong?" for the UK on coronavirus. Was testing and tracing part of this?
A very big part of it. And I think Kath's touched on it perfectly. I think the real issue here is, you know, this is a really bad story for the government. The headlines, you know, whether the press release was mischievous or not, this is a bad story for the government. But I think the reason it's so bad is, you know, a time's going to come when the vaccine bump is gone. Early on in the pandemic, people were really angry with the government. And at some point, there'll be a public inquiry. It might be led by a judge or an independent investigator. And it's going to examine that question of why the UK has had the worst death rate per capita. And, you know, testing is just such a stick that they're going to be hit with, because there was just, you know, a really long list of mistakes. I mean, I've got three dates in front of me. 7th of February, which is when they put up a press release on PHE saying that it was a boast that they were going to increase testing from one lab in London to 12 across the UK, which would mean they could do 1,000 a day. March the 12th, mass testing was abandoned.
You're talking about last year.
Last year.
The whole thing has gone on more than a year now.
And then 1st of May, which was the sort of arbitrary Operation Moonshot 100,000 a day, even though there wasn't a working app at the time. So, you know, testing really has been a real failure of government, I think, throughout this. And I think that's why any story now that looks at it in this context is just such a, you know, when that time comes to take the long view of what went wrong. And you know, I don't think anyone can say that it hasn't gone badly wrong in this country. And testing will be a big part of that.
I'd forgotten about Moonshot. Thanks for reminding us of that. And just take us again with that perspective that you're beaming back to all your viewers in the US. How do you balance out failures on tests and tracing, the big death rate, with the vaccine program at the moment?
It's, you know, you can really trace a lot of these things through early on in the pandemic, where, you know, it's hard to say if it would have got as bad if it happened at the time. But I think, you know, we did reach a point where testing was just so inadequate that the virus suddenly spiked and we were suddenly in lockdown. And then, as Kath said, you know, they made this claim that test and trace was going to be the thing that avoided further lockdown. So I think it's possible, you know, you can possibly say it's more of a comms issue than anything, but I think it's something where there's just repeated mistakes, repeated things they can be hit with. And I just think every story about around this is so damaging, which is why the pivot to vaccines, which has been, you know, has been a success, and will probably take us out of lockdown sooner than a lot of other European countries.
I guess the other difference is that, I mean, vaccines, you know, they work regardless of the spread of infection, but test and tracing gets incredibly more difficult if the infection is really widespread in the population. And
yeah, sure. I mean, one, you know, I've forgotten the term, when they move from the phase of isolate to contain to delay, I think was the term they used at the time.
Mitigate,
that was it. And, you know,
I remember them well.
Yeah. And I just think, you know, the function of the vaccine is obviously very different to the function of trying to contain the spread of a deadly virus. And, you know, whether it's fair or not is kind of irrelevant when the time comes for the inquiry. You know, a lot of this stuff is going to look very bad retrospectively, I think.
Well, I can't offer us a reprieve on that because we're going to stay with coronavirus for our third topic, and that's the row over nurses' pay. I want to bring in now Graham Atkins, our senior fellow, who's one of our top researchers on public services and how they spend the money they get. Hi, Graham.
Hi, Bronwyn.
Thank you for joining us. Well, the government's recommended that NHS staff in England should receive a 1% pay increase this year, and that's been met with a major backlash from the press, from the Royal College of Nurses, from the head of the NHS and the Labour opposition. What's your reading of this, and what do the figures really mean?
Yeah, so this row really emerged on Friday last week, and it came from the Department of Health and Social Care's submission to something called the NHS Pay Review Body. So that body is essentially a team of experts. They listen to submissions from the department, from trade unions, from other interested parties, and then they make a recommendation about how much staff should be paid, given the government's ambitions to recruit and retain numbers of staff to deliver their goals. So in the submission, the department said that pay rises had to be fair and affordable. And so they were particularly worried about the strain that coronavirus had placed on the UK's public finances, the pretty bleak outlook for pay in the private sector, and concluded from that a pay rise of about 1% would be appropriate for most NHS staff, although it's worth saying that doctors and dentists are covered separately. So this isn't the end of the story. The pay review body is now going to listen to trade unions, it's going to listen to others, and it will make a recommendation in May this year about what NHS pay should be next year. And so when it does that, it's going to try and balance how much that will cost against kind of how much it needs to spend to recruit and retain enough staff. And then the government will make a decision about whether to accept or reject that. So that probably would be the kind of obvious point for the government to perhaps reverse course, which obviously they're under a lot of political pressure at the minute to do.
And what do you make of the argument that 1% is more money than it looks? That's not a joke. I'm thinking of a column that Robert Colville of the Centre for Policy Studies wrote in the Sunday Times saying, look, the way the NHS pays its people is very, very complicated. There are lots and lots of tiers, and people tend to progress within those tiers every year or two and tend to get an automatic pay rise because of that and then get the annual one on top. And so most staff will be getting quite a pay rise. Is that justification of the government's position, or is there less in that than it seems?
I mean, Robert Colville is definitely right to say that kind of even if there were no pay rise at all, some staff would be paid more next year than they are this year because they move up the NHS kind of pay grades and pay spines. I think ultimately the best way to think about this is really about the recruitment and retention pressures on the NHS. So one way to assess whether you're paying staff enough is quite simply, are kind of vacancies and retention rates getting better or are they getting worse? And although there was quite a substantial and generous NHS pay deal between 2018 and 2020, that came after the context of a really long period of pay freeze since 2010. And in fact, kind of in real terms, when you think about how much NHS staff can buy with the wages that they have, they were quite a lot lower in 2020 than in 2010. And we know that we entered this crisis with about 40,000 nurse vacancies. We know that retention rates were getting worse before. So I would suggest probably that a pay rise is probably necessary to make sure you recruit and retain enough staff. And ultimately, if the government thinks that kind of 1% is sufficient, then it probably needs to explain why it will be able to recruit and retain enough staff with that. It may be able to do it if they also have in place other kind of good bonuses or manage to change the workplace culture of the NHS to improve it. But I'm not totally sold on the argument that 1% is more generous than it looks.
Well, thanks for that. And okay, you made an important point about recruitment and retention. Alex, what do you think the government should make of the uproar? Should it? How much should it judge what it's done by that?
They've got to balance the benefit, such as it is to the public finances, of keeping a fairly tight rein on pay with the political cost of not doing it. I mean, it does seem, Graham brilliantly set out the process there, and there are various opportunities on that process for the government to reverse course. But it does seem like they're taking an enormous political hit for a very, very popular group of workers who've just gone through the most sort of extraordinary year. It does seem unsustainable to me. And for what we're talking about, sort of hundreds of millions of pounds, which, you know, in the context of the billions we were just talking about in Test and Trace, is a drop in the ocean, really. So it seems like a very high political cost for actually not that much money.
Yeah. And Luke, what do you make of this? I mean, is it bad politics or fiscal realism? Not a lot of money around.
Yeah, I mean, I'm only really qualified to talk about the politics of this. But I think, I think the case for giving a significant pay rise is probably quite compelling. And I'm one of those people who thinks in most instances, most instances of public spending, governments can largely structure their finances in a way to have some fiscal flexibility. But it seems, you know, this is a government that has a bit of a problem with the NHS generally. You know, it banged pots and pans outside Number 10 for the NHS, but ultimately the Conservative Party isn't generally trusted on the NHS. So, you know, one stories about a 1% rise, you know, they aren't going to go down well with a lot of people. But on the other side of that, you've got a lot of Tory MPs who have become very worried about how susceptible Boris Johnson's become to U-turns. I mean, if you see the Marcus Rashford stuff, they worry about the precedent of setting up, you know, U-turning because of public pressure, because, you know, as again we've seen with Rashford, once you do one, the pressure really mounts when you do it again. So it's a politically
really, about free school meals.
It's anything that involves greater spending because of public pressure goes down really badly of a lot of Tory voters. I think what I'd normally say about this story is that it's actually the kind of issue where, you know, the people who are angry about it on one side or the other would probably never vote Tory or, you know, would never vote Labour. But the thing I'm sort of interested in, I suppose, is how true that is now with this new reality of the red wall turned blue and the sort of new appeal to Tory voters who, you know, don't generally agree with a small state and all that sort of stuff. So I think it's a really difficult position for them, because I can't really see a solution where Boris Johnson comes out of it smelling of roses.
Well, and it got worse for him this week, didn't it, Kath? I mean, I wonder if you can take us into the row with the opposition, because we had on Tuesday, we had Sir Simon Steele, head of the NHS England, telling a committee of MPs that the 2019 long-term plan for the NHS pay had set out a 2.1% rise. But then on Wednesday, Boris Johnson declared that Keir Starmer, the Labour leader, had previously voted against that 2.1% rise, and the Commons Speaker, Lindsay Hoyle, has accepted Labour's clarification that this is factually incorrect. Should Boris Johnson just say sorry for this one?
I mean, it's one of these things of, yes, the Commons rules, you know, are very clear. The ministerial code is very clear. You know, even if it's inadvertent, even if you misspoke or you were given the wrong information, you should correct the record and you should apologise. But he's probably not going to, because, and that's partly just, you know, he's sort of dug himself in, the Prime Minister's press secretary. She's dug herself in on this. It's also, we've seen a few examples of this in recent weeks. And, you know, Boris Johnson is keen to score some of these political points. I mean, just quickly, it goes back to a sort of wider question about this, which is yet again, how they sort of handled the, you know, their communication around this, because they haven't set it out in the way that Graham has just done. You know, instead we've seen arguments coming of, actually, you know, it is a good pay rise, which, you know, as we've already discussed, whether that is or is not true. We also saw, though, comments like, oh, it's okay, we can recruit more nurses, so it'll be okay in that. I saw another comment today, I think, that, you know, coming from the government, I believe, that was something about, if their partners have been on furlough, then, you know, they won't take the same kind of financial hit. So there's something about how the government's communicated all of this. And so what Boris Johnson tried to do was pivot and try and drag Labour back into this. So I don't think he's going to apologise because he wants that political point to have hit. And he probably thinks, perhaps quite rightly, that people won't notice whether or not, you know, he misled the House of Commons. They'll notice him making that argument. So it's a sort of appeal to the base calculation that he's factored into all of this. But yes, if he respects the rules of the House of Commons, he ought to apologise for something like this and correct it.
And as you said, his press secretary, Allegra Stratton, was asked many, many times if he was going to apologise, and she dodged the question. Graham, I wonder, could you just tell us what happens next? What about the pay review body and all this?
Yeah, so in essence, the pay review body continues to listen to other stakeholders, mostly trade unions, who will send evidence to it. They then will consider all of that, and as of May, it will make a recommendation to the government for what it thinks NHS pay should be next year. That recommendation is non-binding, so the government could choose to, you know, a lower rate or a higher rate, but in practice, both for nurses, but also for doctors and the police and for teachers who also have independent pay boards, the government usually accepts the recommendation.
So what do you all think will happen? U-turn? Stick with it?
I think there'll be a U-turn. The only question, I think, is if the private sector is really starting to suffer by the, you know, late spring, middle of the year, and people are starting to see the point that the government is, you know, presumably has in the back of its mind, which is that there is going to be some real pain outside the public sector, and that might start to change the dynamic. But I'm not sure that's going to happen quickly enough for this. So I predict a U-turn.
I think it's very likely there'll be a U-turn. If there's one thing we know about this government, it's that it can't ride out bad press. It's obsessed with media, obsessed with media strategy, which is sort of ironic given how so much of it's gone over the last 12 months. But I think that it's very likely that we'll end up in that position.
Okay, well, let's take it there. A couple of votes for U-turns. We'll have to see what happens. With that, that's going to be it for this edition of Inside Briefing. So my great thanks to Kath Haddon, Alex Thomas, Graham Atkins and Luke McGee. Brilliant to have you with us. If you enjoy this podcast, then head to IFG Live, which is our sister podcast channel. Lots of terrific new episodes there, including my discussion with three former chancellors at once, George Osborne, Norman Lamont and Alistair Darling. You can listen to all our podcasts at iTunes, Acast, Spotify, wherever you get your podcasts. Please do leave us a review too. We're aiming for Oprah-style viewing figures. And check out all our work at instituteforgovernment.org.uk. That's the end of the podcast. And unlike Piers Morgan, I and everyone else didn't storm off halfway through. Have a good week, everyone.